This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress on location with two Baltimore poets, David Bodwin and Jeffrey Himes. And so we're going to hear a poem from each so you'll know who is who. And we're going to start with Jeffrey. Let us hear your voice, Jeffrey.
This is a poem that I co-wrote with our host, Grace Cavalieri, for a book called The Third Voice. And the book title came from this idea that when we worked together to write these poems, it wasn't her voice that she usually uses, or my voice that I usually use, but a third voice, which made it a different, something new. And the title of this poem is The Legend of Lancaster County. All the witnesses agreed the bank robber had two heads. One head said, "Give me all your money." The other head said, "No, please don't." Harry, the left head, controlled the right side. Donnie, the right head, controlled the left. Each head claimed innocence. Each head blamed the other. The cops called it a crime. The lawyers called it a family feud. The wife the brothers shared could not testify against either one. Her name was Matilda, ashamed that she only had one head. How much easier it would be if she had a head for each brother. The brothers argued and she wept. This went on for years. The operation to give her a second head would cost $80,000. "We could rob a bank," said Harry, "but it would be wrong." "No," said Donnie, "it would be right." "Please don't do it," pleaded Matilda. Donnie wore a lion mask. Harry wore a horse mask. Matilda wore cold cream and watched the evening news. They were counting the money when the cops burst in. Not hard to find a two-headed bank robber in Lancaster County. Now it's visiting hour at the prison. Matilda looks at Donnie's head, at Harry's head. She looks at the reflection of her one head in the plexiglass window.
I think we're dangerous, really dangerous. Now, David Bodwin, come in with a poem.
This is a poem called Tugboats, The Tugboats, from a recent collection that just came out this spring called On Down the Line. The Tugboats. The orange and ready tugboats strut across the evening water, nodding through your wishes of some extra world. Cold is not a word for the wind. It is French, indifferent. Elsewhere, shrugging waves, only tugboats resolve. Where we pause from these windy ramparts out, this world appears friendly, as most things do from far away. To sit down with a second cup of coffee and a knife and continue, far from me, strength glistens in its hole, at bay. The men who steer these tugboats across our vision are weaker than they imagine. Their feeble motion to collect themselves is lent majesty by the grander movement of their ships, the sea, this afternoon which tears the asking eye. How many voyages have they, as I do now, desired nothing but to fling themselves across the most dangerous void between themselves and another? Mm. Then, always, they realize their work depends on strangers and their lines snake crazily through the impenetrable air. What I want even to say is not hatred. One should and must have a heart swollen enough to stagger into when friends and bolt the door behind, when children come begging for midnight candy, when friends carve their names in our breath. Sometimes love goes bad by lunch. Even the cat won't eat it. And yet the noble tugboats have never set a course for themselves, nor forsaken the harbor for exotic ports, retrieving ships with painted eyes. Intuitive, they know the sea returns, casting the lines that draw us together.
I am so glad I paired these two poems by accident, the gleeful and the lyrical. And that is a good, both have achieved all kinds of poetry, but it was very interesting to hear these opening poems. David, since I have you here right away, tell us where we can find this poem if we want to read it.
Well, it's in a book called On Down the Line from a local press in Ellicott City, Maryland, called Uncollected Press. So they're easily found online, as I said. You can also find them in local bookstores.
How about your present book, your newest book?
This is my newest book.
That's what I wanted you to say. Uh-huh. It's just out. And when you look at the poems that you've collected, what is the story you're telling yourself over and over? What is it that you're saying in all of these poems? Because we're all telling a story over and over. So looking at the themes in this poem, do you think there's anything that resonates with the rest of your work?
I think so. I mean, that's a really big question to ask. So
I think themes, I would say themes is another way to put it. I get in this poem the longing for getting together, the longing for togetherness,
mm-hmm.
and the darkness of being individual and solitude. Mm-hmm. So I just feel there's something in that poem. And I'm thinking of your other work, and if that is not typical of you.
Well, you know, let me see. So being, I guess in my younger life, I was fairly isolated. So that probably plays both geographically and I guess sort of individually. So I would imagine that plays a part in it somewhat. But I think as most poets are kind of searchers, they're always looking for the other.
There you go.
And, you know, that's, you know, it's sort of like those.
That says it all, David. That says it all. I couldn't have said it or heard it more beautifully. There is that longing for the other. Maybe it's the poem. Maybe it's the poem, something that won't go bad by lunch, you know. That's so beautiful. Let's hear another from you, David, since you're here.
Okay. This is from an earlier chapbook, letterpress chapbook, that came out in 2025 called Afters. And basically, they're all very loose sonnets. It's funny because this poem actually is a prompt to what you just said, or a response, maybe is a better word. After all, it was you. You who I found only when I'd empty out my pockets of all hope. You pitching cheap drinks in a dugout dive, Dickens tucked in your purse. You leaving one more dress in my closet after each stay. The perfect silence embracing our vows, goofy stories, such laughter that stitches our lives as one. No money, a baby, dogs and cats, and your heart always a home. You, years now sifting in October leaves in your grave green eyes. All past sorrows now slip away as we lie here in some dark. You and I, one true world. I never guessed within love, still together, oddly blessed.
I think we're proving the thesis, David, without knowing it. So beautiful. I'll tell you who he is. He is an educator, a poet, and an editor. And I call him an historian, too. The author of 7 books of poetry. Most recently, we mentioned Afters. And then before that, On Down the Line. And I think, no, On Down the Line is the 30-year collection of the work.
Right.
And David's poem, Annunciation, was included in the Best American Poetry Anthology for 2025. Much crave and much and very competitive. So thank you, David. Nice. Jeffrey has been published in many publications, and he's written about popular music for the Washington Post, New York Times, Downbeat, Rolling Stone, and many more since 1977. And we've been reading him since 1977. Much decorated music critic. I always say he's the best in the country, and I know because I've read him since 1977. And What is there, Jeff, since you already have a handle on journalism and musicology, and you are well known, I mean, it's your a synonym for your name. Why poetry? I mean, what didn't you get already? What satisfaction did you need that only poetry can fill?
Well, when you're a critic, which I think of as another kind of art form, I mean, you're trying to give shape to feelings and ideas through words, like you would if you're writing a novel or a poem, if you're writing criticism the way I think you should write it. but it's also a reactive kind of medium, because you're reacting to somebody else's creativity. You know, if you're reviewing a film or an album or a play or a book or whatever, you're sort of, you know, responding to something else, something that somebody else initiated. And you can do that in a very artful way and a very, you know, cathartic way, but you're still reacting. And so for me, the outlet of writing poems and writing song lyrics, which I also do, is a way to be, to take the initiative, you know, to be the one who starts the conversation rather than responds. So
well said. Right. And do people ask you that question a lot, or just me?
Just you mostly, but
well, that's good enough. Everybody's going to hear it today anyway. And this leads us to your book, your new book. Talk about it. Let's hear about it. What's in it?
Right. So, you know, I've written a lot of songs. I've written a lot of poems, but I had never really published a book of poetry for a long time because I was very busy with my journalism career. And Grace invited me to collaborate with her on two books.
When you got the third voice, of me, you did your own.
Yeah, the third voice and Fables from Italy and Beyond, which were great. But then I had all these poems written by myself that had been piling up hundreds and hundreds for years. And so I decided, mm-hmm. Well, I'm going to put together a book of those. And it's called Today I Am an Orphan, the Shorter Poems of Jeffrey Himes. Came out earlier this year on Bunny and Crocodile Press. And, you know, it was good to just sort of like get them out of the desk drawer and into the world. I'll read something from that book now.
That's what we want.
This is called The Pond. The same tannin that makes this pond as dark as strong tea preserves its buried bodies. Every once in a while, gas will expand within a torso and float it into view, the nose above the surface, the shoulders below, a boy, a lost memory. But it's never the body I want to see, the woman with the brown hair parted at the middle into twin braids. Mm. I want to stare into that face, a reflection of the moon upon the pond, until I learn how it could be so kind and then so cruel. But it's never her flesh that rises through the decaying leaves and falling snags. It's always someone else's face, the answer to someone else's question.
That, the braids get me. The braids get me. The detail. You are known for your viscerous approach to poetry, the sights, the sounds, the smells, the dark tea-colored lake. But it's the braids that we will remember there. Thank you for so much. Now, I want everyone to know that in addition to being a practice poet, you have written popular music for The Post, The New York Times, The Downbeat, The Rolling Stone, and many others. And your books include In Law Country, How Emmylou Harris, Roseanne Cash, and Their Circle Fashioned a New Kind of Country Music in 2024. And I'm going to give your credentials little by little because we only have a small program. We'd be up all night. So back to David. David is a poetry historian. I'm the one that calls him that, so we know it's true, because he chronicles poetry from the past and presents them in the present and gives them a context so that we understand the content in the time and history they were written. And most notable are the New York School of Poets in the mid-50s. So, David, you've paid so much attention to them. Why What do they contribute to the American canon, and why are you so obsessed with them?
Well, you know, it's, I would not call it an obsession, but
oh, it has to be. It's so beautiful.
It's kind of, well, I would call it a passion, but that's I guess sort of engagement with that group of poets really goes back, oh my gosh, almost 50 years, when I was first introduced to them in undergraduate school, and outside of the classroom, I might add, you know, just been referenced by friends. And it represented, now, you know, of those sort of three, I guess you would say, post-World War II American schools of poetry, sort of outside the academy. So, I mean, you're talking about, you know, the Beats / San Francisco Renaissance, Black Mountain, and then finally what's loosely called the New York School. I found myself probably drawn most immediately, like a lot of teenagers are, to the Beats, you know, the you know, City Lights books that, you know, you could pick up cheaply, and read Howl and Coney Island of the Mind by Lawrence Ferlinghetti, Getty, et cetera, et cetera. But once I was tagged by at least the first generation of New York School, mainly Frank O'Hara, Kenneth Koch, Barbara Guest, and certainly John Ashbery, it kind of you know, whatever makes that light go on in your head, reading those poets certainly did. So I've been following that, and it's kind of a multi-generational cohort, if you want to call it that, because it's not just those four people, but the a second, and then finally a third generation that came after that. And it kind of dissipated, I would say, at that point by the end of the 70s, early 80s. I mean, there's a lot of those poets, if they haven't passed, are certainly still active. But I was always curious, you know, why New York? Why then? I mean, most of, outside of those original four who were, you know, obviously classically trained and from fairly well-to-do backgrounds, it was very much of a very ragged group of people without any money.
Bohemians.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, I hate to use the cliche, but you're right. It's they were bohemians, and they were very sort of circumscribed by contemporary poetry. You know, they were, as I believe the poet Maureen Owen told me, no one paid attention to us, so we could do whatever we wanted to. There was a great deal of collaboration, and performance, and all of that sort of stuff came into play. So it's just a fascinating time for me. And
people need to know that you still feature this on your Substack newsletter, New York Poets, and you have had conversations with people that are still alive, that are influenced by them. And also, the visual arts affected them, right? The abstract expressionism
was
prominent then. So you go into many rivers when you write about them, and people can get that Substack by just Googling your name.
Sure.
Okay.
Sure. I mean, it's right. Yeah. It's called, New York Poets IOU.
They can get that from Googling.
Oh, sure.
It. Okay. Yeah.
Easy to find.
Well, let us hear two poems.
Okay. Let's see. So I wanted to read actually an earlier poem from a sequence that I wrote in the, I guess it was right around 1980. It's called The American Night. And it was my first attempt at writing sort of loose sonnets, which has taken over my life at this point, in terms of a kind of a form that I engage in. Okay, so these are not numbered, but they were 14 of loose sonnets in this sequence. In white patches of light on wood floor, new land. Relieved, I fix the shower so my people will have rain. Marriage these two opposites and a flag. Work is alchemical, I was told at meditation camp. Now cars move the nights to one side. Nothing spooky about silence. Somebody's else or my own, a habit like leather shoes one still wears till earth roughs his heel. Our lives spent dismantling these excuses, amused to the end. Indeed, it is a skull, my lord. Its gravity approaches that of angels beating rayon tambourines against the painted nails of midnight. Imagine death, the speed limit that lies. You cannot drive too fast.
So witty, so witty. Do you have another one? That's
yeah.
Sonnet?
And this is actually one that you were present for at, as Jeff mentioned, we all gather every spring in Chestertown for the Antioch Poets Retreat. And this poem came out of the most recent one this year. After Louise Gluck. It will make no forms but twisted forms, this life. But stare at it long enough, and shapes do emerge, like gazing at clouds and wanting more than a simple outline without a voice. Here is his face, hers, a house where you grew older but then left, that better world that did not come when called. Instead, these years took their own shape, and you with it, scars and all, stitching lines. Even now you cannot fully recall, except when you glance into a mirror to greet that indifferent stranger.
You nailed her. I'm beginning to notice for you, in, so that you'll notice, mm-hmm. that there is always an other in your poems off stage.
Right.
And oftentimes in theater, the person off stage is the most interesting person.
Oh, yeah.
Even if it's the person you're sleeping with in one poem, or the tugboat captain with another, or a famous poet. So there is this together, this feeling I get from your poetry of some solidarity with other. And I think it's almost in every poem, said in so many different ways, but it's always the same thing, the bond, we're better with the bond than without it in all of your poems. So interesting. Jeff, because David gave us a prelude into the Baltimore School, we want to hear what you think about it, since you are a progenitor.
Yeah, I think we were talking before we started about, you know, the New York School There's a sort of an unacknowledged school of Baltimore poetry that sort of centered around Grace and her students at Antioch College in the early 70s, and then, you know, to include myself and Ellen Carter and Paul Bartlett and John Doe, who went on to form the band X, and
Gail Saunders,
Paul Bartlett. And then, you know, people who are also in the Baltimore community, like David and Alan Britt and Jennifer Keith and so on and so forth. And there's a sense of, when I was listening to David's tugboat poem, there's a sense of Baltimore where things are sort of much more down to earth than a lot of literary scenes. You know, it's the tugboats in the harbor. It's the people hanging out in the streets, and the language is more sort of earthy and. It's like people, the thing I've always liked about Baltimore is that nobody puts on airs. You know, this is what you see is what you get. So, and I think that comes through the poetry. And even though, you know, this is decades later, you know, we still gather, you know, once a year on the Eastern Shore, Washington College. We have groups that we meet monthly. And there's a real, sense of community without having sort of a, you know, a literary dress code where you have to write a certain way, that there's, it's more, be yourself as much as possible.
Authenticity is a perfect way you have said it. There's the tribe and then there's the family. And the fire you sit next to is the one where you get the most warmth. Because if someone says your name in California, who cares? If that's fame, I don't need it. But sitting status is comes from community, and we got it to give, honey. We got it. So let's have two poems from Jeffrey.
All right. Well, I'll read two shorter ones now at this point. So this is a, speaking of sonnets, this is a sort of a loose sonnet. It's from my new book, Today I Am an Orphan. It's called In the Cardiologist's Office. Mm. The doctor said my heart once was made of wood, but now was made of glass. It might last for years. It might shatter tomorrow. Beware of tiny hammers. He put me on a death watch, but now I see I have always been on a death watch. I am a toy soldier assembled from breakable parts and ordered to march. Peek through the window of my heart, but please don't tap on the pain.
Talk about the extended metaphor. That is immortal, immortal. And another poem, Jeffrey.
There's another short one. Time zones. Flowers open, flowers close, and we never see them move. Light and lightning both travel through the air from their home to ours, and we never catch the gesture. So much of the world is on a different clock. When we dance, my love, come closer so we can synchronize our watches.
So sweet. If you want more Jeffrey, and who doesn't, you can get this book, Today I Am an Orphan, The Shorter Poems of Jeffrey Himes, brand new this year, and it's available. But also, most interesting to me is his podcast and recent writing are found at Hard Rain and Pink Cadillac, and that's a Substack site, Hard Rain and Pink Cadillac. Why that title, Jeff?
Well, it's, you know, it's a site about music, and you know, the sort of spectrum to me is, you know, the sort of serious prophetic kind of songs like Hard Rain's Gonna Fall or Who'll Stop the Rain, Purple Rain, and then the sort of more fun loving, you know, go out and have an adventure, you know, Pink Cadillac by, you know, Elvis Presley and Bruce Springsteen and Aretha Franklin, all have Pink Cadillac songs, and so it sort of defines the spectrum.
I had a boyfriend with a pink Cadillac in high college, but I wasn't allowed to see him anymore because we found out how he bought that. Fabulous, Jeffrey. Fabulous. One last thing for you. Not one last, but everyone wants to know the same thing, and you've been saying it over and over. You might as well put it on a loop. How do you navigate the difference between lyrics in your songwriting and poetry on the page?
Well, to me, it, you know, The analogy I always use is that, you know, poetry is like fiction. It has to be self-sufficient on the page. You know, whatever effects it's going to produce in the reader are done with the page. Whereas songs are like plays. You know, they use words, but they also use other artistic means to make their impact. You know, like a play, you can read it on a page, but it doesn't really come to life until you have actors and sets and stage, you know, and it's a live performance. And then all of a sudden, you know, it means a lot more than it does when you read it. Songs are the same way. You know, you can read it on the page, but it's really not until you have the music and the voice and the instruments that it really comes to life. Mm. And so they're just, to me, they're different art forms. You know, they're related. There's a lot of overlap, of course, but, you know, to say that, you know, song lyrics or poetry, or, you know, poetry or song lyrics, to me, it doesn't make sense.
Well, some people say you could just lift the lyrics off the page, off the script, and have a poem, but that's really not true, right?
You have something you can read, but it's not, it doesn't have it, it's designed, it's not designed for that. It's designed to be played married to music, you know, and part of the trick of writing lyrics is that you have to make room for the music. You have to, you know, accommodate the music, whereas a poet on the page can disregard that. They can do whatever they want, you know.
I hope people will stop asking you now that we've made this final, and it's now a credential. David, you have been writing for 50 years, and I'm proud of that. I'm not ashamed of my age. And so how do you think you're different now than the way you were? And then I want you to look at the bigger umbrella. What do you see about poetry 50 years ago that you didn't realize until now? So do it on the personal level and on a more ubiquitous level.
Are you talking about the state of poetry today?
That too, but your own state first. Where have you come from and where are you going? And is it the same thing? Because I think my early poems are as good as my late ones, which showed no progress whatsoever.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, you know, I think that, you know, in the world of music, just to bounce off of what Jeff was just saying, there's this term that old blues artists use called woodshedding, which means you just go and you practice off by yourself. And, you know, I mean, I felt that a lot of when I started writing in junior high school, college, graduate school, I was still learning. You know, I really don't feel that.
What were you learning?
Well, for example, you know, when I was in college, I deliberately, because the stuff I was doing in high school was basically, you know, I was following a lot of the, you know, popular musicians and the lyrics that they were, you know, I mean, like Bob Dylan, obviously, and others, because I was fascinated with their lyrics, to me, which was spoke to me more as poetry than the 19th century stuff I was looking at in the classroom. And then beyond that, when I first discovered the beat writers, as a lot of teenage young writers do, I immediately started sort of copying that style. So I mean, I was basically learning how to write by basically copying other people.
Who didn't?
Exactly. So that copying, and then in college, to you know, as another point, I decided I need to write in strict form for a year, just to do it.
To punish yourself.
Just to punish myself. And that, I think, helped enormously, because when I then stepped away from that, I had a much keener ear for the sonics of a poem, the sounds, the rhythms, meter, if you want to call it that. And I was able to sort of bring that more organically into my own work.
Organically.
Or intuitively, maybe it's a better word, into my own work than I was ever able to do before. I think what I find to be a kind of, and God, I'm now going to sound like the old man yelling at the cloud, right? But a lot of younger poets now are not schooled in the, if you want to call it the history of poetry, but just forms.
Even their antecedents.
Yeah, just, you know, to know where you came from, you know, and to know where the form came from. I mean, you know, there is some merit to you know, that old line that I think that Chaucer, I think, stole from a Greek poet, but the life so short, the craft so hard to learn, or too long to learn. So the craft so long to learn. It you know, it really takes a while. I think at this point, I'm probably writing better poems than I ever have before. Even though I'm sort of, you know, ancient of days at this point.
Well, let us prove it with a final poem.
Okay. Well, I'll read that poem then that appeared in Best American Poetry 2025. This poem is another Baltimore poem called Annunciation. For my sins, I live in the city of Baltimore, immutable as it staggers into the sea, its crooked shore uncertain of any harbor, impure and beautiful, like a cigarette butt in last night's drink. So must I think, like Poe with an aching head, of dark and transcendent things that drift from those alleys, follow us back to our little blue home. Let these poems be our fiery word in these haunted streets, turning all shades but our own to things as real as stone, where we can read our death has not been written yet. Even with monsters at the edges, it is a map where we can live. This city they keep building as it falls. The water's current carries everything away but what we feel, who we loved, where we went that night for crabs and beer. It will never be more real than here.
I bow to you. Jeffrey, before we hear a final poem, what do you think we're doing? I mean, you've been on the edge of the commercial world. Nothing is more material and has a bigger stall in the marketplace than the music industry. So you've watched it and you've evaluated it. And then we come to poetry where you told us that you did it for your own sense of self. And I understand that because your being was not expressed in being a critic. But why are we doing it at all? Why poetry? What's it about?
Well, it's the same as any art form. I mean, we're trying to, I always tell, when I teach, which hasn't been very often, but when I teach, I tell students, you know, you're not writing for yourself. You're not writing for, you know, if you're writing criticism, you're not writing for the artist. You're writing to reach the reader. The reader is really the person you're trying to connect with. And you're trying to, like, you know, give them something that will allow them to think about the world in a new way. I mean, that's what excited me about reading when I was young. Was like, you know, you read something, say, oh yeah, I never thought about it that way. And, you know, and when somebody does that for you, and I think that you have the impulse that you want to do it for somebody else, and that we're that it's you know, it's not so much what the poem or the song or movie says about the creator; it's what it says about the receiver. You know, mm-hmm. you know, when I hear a song or read a poem, it's what's exciting about it. It's not what it says about the poet or the songwriter, but what it says about me, about my life, the people I know, you know, how it will help me perceive the world around me.
And preserving those braids is not a small thing. Yes. I think we're all in search of the new. And as children, we had limitless imaginations and we just love to go there again. So I would like the final poem from you, Jeff.
This is another Baltimore poem, although it's sort of based on William Butler Yeats. It's called The Second Coming. This is also in my new book. What rough beast, star chosen and star crossed, slouches towards Baltimore to be born? What small child under a 40-watt bulb in a basement basket of mud and straw is now asked to be a millennium's messiah? What naked monkey announces the second coming with an arc of urine, a sagging fontanelle, and piercing vowels without consonants? What strangers, what social workers shepherding their flocks, what East Side kings presenting their contraband gifts, what limping matriarchs with maimed wings now crowd through the door to bear witness? What never Virgin Mary in a blue mantle surrounded by teenage boys chewing the air like cows and donkeys, like lifts the howling mouth to her purpled nub of a breast? Mary, already remembering the shrapnel delights and despairs to come for this man-child in a promised land, already following the golden-handled casket, already singing just a closer walk with thee, lifts the squalling babe from the basket, wraps him in a cocoa-colored blanket, and carries him into the glassy December night, beneath the smoldering streetlights, past the empty eye-socket buildings, untouched by the whiz-whistling bullets, undeterred by the dark's garbled hollering toward Christmas morning's eastern horizon, dawn's rose-blushed, blood-stained edge, and its imminent uncertain epiphany.
A little bit of the Jesuit education wrapped in whole cloth there coming through. And this is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress on location with two Baltimore poets, David Bodwin and Jeffrey Himes. The program is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions, post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We want to thank our funders, the Sinibit Fund, the Rivada Foundation of the Logan Family, and friends of the program, Avidesha Shani, Young Ki Kim Renault, Natalie Canavore, and Sandy Jackson Cohen. Mike Turpin's our engineer, and I am Grace Cavalieri.